by my own name, I can dine out, go to the opera, and vacation at the shore undisturbed. I doubt if any of my alter egos could do as much. Well, hey, friends, how you doing? This is Keith Tyler, bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sunsound of Arizona. Thank you so much for joining me. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and John J. McKeon bring us our first story. It's called The Great Wolf. I live and work in a house in which a horrible crime was committed many years ago. It suits me. The event's notoriety was long faded, even the oldest neighbors, taking their companionable evening walk, barely give the house a glance, although they surely remember. Nobody drives slowly by, pointing as they explain the story to their cousins from out of town. Not in decades has anyone taken a snapshot. I have researched that grisly triple murder sufficiently to know all of these things happened at the time and for some years afterwards. I do not feel haunted here, although my father thought I was certain to. He warned that both my work and my sanity would surely suffer from too long a bath in such bad karma. But Dad is gone now, rest his soul, while I am still here. And still, I think, sane. As to my work, one would have to concede it has gone well enough. I write under three different pseudonyms, each of which has produced multiple bestsellers in the last 20 years. All of my books have been reprinted as paperbacks, most are still on the bookstore shelves, and two have been made into movies. I will go yet a step further and declare that I was thoroughly satisfied with both films, a sign not of complete sanity, perhaps, but of enough mental competence to know a buck when I see one. By my own name, I can dine out, go to the opera, and vacation at the shore undisturbed. I doubt any of my alter egos could do as much. I'm a wealthy man. I can live anywhere I want. I will live in this house until I die. And since I have no descendants or other kin close enough to force me, against my will, into unassisted living or hospice, I fully expect to keel over one fine morning as I search my refrigerator for a missing stick of butter. But that day, I hope, is still far off. Meanwhile, I live and I work. Of the two upstairs rooms where the blood was shed, I use the larger as my own bedroom, and I sleep long and soundly every night. The second room serves as a guest room, for I do have occasional overnight guests, and unless these visitors know what to look for, they will sense nothing amiss. Multiple bleachings and paintings have done away with nearly all the bloodstains. The faint circles that remain on the hardwood floor can be passed off as water damage from a distant storm. Being a writer, I have both a vivid imagination and susceptible nature, so the images do crowd into my mind from time to time. I see the spurt of carotid blood, the soaked nightgown clinging to pubescent breasts. I hear the stomp of bare feet as the enraged father searches the house for the child who has thus far eluded him. I am equally adept at pushing these images away. And if they don't move along peacefully, I have not one but three ways to redirect them. Eric Chason writes detective stories in the time-honored noir tradition, tales of urban knights whose moral codes are battered but constant. Magnus Lupo does science fiction with a tilt toward time travel. Melanie Knight crafts finely wrought short-form fiction, acutely observed and meticulously reordered with an unparalleled blend of ironic distance and searing realism. That's not me talking. those words all come from actual reviews. Some critics consider it a disgrace that Melanie doesn't have a Pulitzer yet. Among the three of them, these fine wordsmiths can accommodate any kind of nightmare, I think. I am no hermit. Still, less a misanthrope, I interact with my fellow humans regularly and with appropriate gusto or disgust, as suits each occasion. So the sound of my telephone that February morning was hardly unwelcome. I was at work, though, and since it was the landline, I assumed it was neither personal nor important. Personal important calls would come to my cell. So 2 hours passed before I checked my answering machine and heard, "Mr. Lopo, this is Jennifer Bryce of Cable News Network. I'm a producer with our show New Leaves, and I'd like to make an appointment to come and talk to you about your most recent books and what you're working on now. Of course, if you don't want to talk about what you're working on now, that's fine. We understand. We bill ourselves as a book show that's actually nice to authors, which is kind of a pleasant change, so don't you think?" She went on in that vein until her time ran out and probably never realized she hadn't left her number. It was in the phone's history, of course. If I really wanted a call back, I'm normally amenable to things like this. Promotion, after all, is a big part of a writer's job. Now that the publishing houses have fired everybody who actually worked with books, well, I do have an occasional fantasy in which two of my nom de plume are invited to sit on the same panel, but I did not let it frighten me too much. In any case, Jennifer had a nice voice, and I would probably say yes if she called again. Which she did the next day, while I was out buying what I thought I would need to get through a threatening snowstorm. This time she said, "I must have sounded like 100% ditz in my previous messages, and I'm sorry." Then she gave me her phone number before rambling until the beep. An interview with Jennifer Bryce probably wouldn't put many demands on the interviewee, I thought, and then jotted down the number and went back to work, intending to call when my day's quota was in the can. I was gazing idly out the window, or rather, thinking rigorously about my next plot twist, when the first wisps of snow began. Being hopelessly in love with snow, I couldn't help but watch as the storm settled in, the flakes getting smaller, the wind whipping them in three directions at once. First the grass, and then the pavements whiting out. It was dark when I finally headed down to the kitchen, and Jennifer's call remained unreturned. Yeah, not now, I thought. Now, glass of wine, later a nice steak I had set aside. I watched a few minutes of TV news, rooting for the storm. Perhaps I would build a fire and watch Dr. Zhivago tonight in my flannel PJs, robe, and fuzzy slippers. Our part of the world gets two or three decent snowstorms each winter, and this one might be the last, I reflected as I dug my way from the side door up the driveway. The sky had cleared, but the temperature remained below freezing, and the snow was still fluffy and light, perhaps a foot deep. After half hour, I had cleaned and freed my car and cleaned the drive of the barrier pushed up by the county plow just after dawn. I turned to the front walk, three stone steps up from the sidewalk, then a flagstone path to the second set of stairs leading to the door. The road was covered, but the snow packed down and numerous tread marks testified to its passability. Still, I was surprised to hear a car approach, and still more surprised to see it was not an SUV or truck or even a four-wheel drive, but a generic Japanese sedan, and its driver was clearly overmatched against the modest downslope that ran by my house. She slid first left into the center of the road where the snow was still mounded and rutty. Then, after a reactive jerk of the steering wheel, she veered severely right, hit the brakes, locked her wheels, and skidded slowly but inexorably across the road and into the curbside snowbank. I leaned on my shovel and watched, a little winded from my exertion, and knowing that if she didn't extricate herself quickly, it would be more or less up to me to help. She spun her wheels a moment in reverse, the car's rear end shimmying, seeming to find some traction, moving a foot or so, and then sliding sideways again. The woman turned her front wheels sharply left and tried moving forward, only to drive right back into the gash she had just vacated. She climbed out of the car, popped the trunk, and took out a flimsy shovel, which she carried to the front of the car, bracing herself against the roof with each step. I shouldered my shovel and trudged up to the street. She had embedded herself about 10 yards past my driveway, and I moved slowly, testing the footing and mindful of the incline. The woman attacked the snow under her front wheels. "Eh, don't worry about the front end," I called to her. "You've got rear-wheel drive." "Well, how can you tell that?" she replied without turning. "Those are the wheels that were spinning." She straightened up and turned to me. "You know what?" she said. "I think I'll just call for a tow. That's what roadside assistance is for." "Well, you'll wait all day," I said. "We can get you going quicker than that." "Actually, I'm where I intended to be all along," she said, coming toward me. She wore a ski jacket zipped partway down and a silver scarf that she had knotted only loosely so that her throat could show. Hatless, she had bound her brown hair under a white knit band. "Are you Magnus Lupo?" she said. And I replied, "Who?" She smiled. Her bottom teeth were slightly crooked. "Oh, come on," she said. "I know I have the right address." She pulled off a glove and held out her hand. "I'm Jennifer. Jennifer Bryce. I called a couple of times." "Yes, I know. I intended to call you back, but got a little sidetrack." "Oh, that's okay. I took the chance that you'd be here." "And this seemed like a perfect morning for a leisurely drive," I said. "You came up from the city. In this weather, it must have taken you 2 hours." "Oh, almost." "Why did you think I would be here? Where else would you be on a morning like this? Oh, at my villa on Mykonos, perhaps, mingling with my fellow rich and famous authors?" "I didn't know science fiction paid that well." "Well, it normally doesn't," I replied. "But my work has been translated into Klingon, and that's a gold mine." She laughed boisterously, but briefly, then said, "You know, seriously, I know it's an imposition, but if I just sat in my apartment all day watching TV, I'd go crazy. If you don't want to do the interview, I'll understand." "How about we get you dug out first, then we'll see where we are." She gave me a thumbs up and attacked the snow around the left rear tire while I worked along the car's right side. Edging the curb, instead of tossing the snow back into the middle of the street, she carefully carried each shovelful the length of the car and deposited on the growing mound along the curb. She talked all the while with the kind of ebullience that I normally find very taxing. But she had a pleasant enough voice, a full chest-driven alto of the kind that could anchor a church choir and could, with decent training and practice, be right at home in any number of German Lieder. I didn't mind hearing her as long as I wasn't expected to listen. For Jennifer, the talk was its own reward. She never seemed winded, though I was breathing hard after 5 minutes. Eventually, I joined her at the front of the car, and we dug down to bare pavement for a few feet. The day was brightening, and the snow was getting heavier. "Let the sun work on that for a while, and you'll have no trouble," I said, trying not to pant. "Can I offer you a cup of coffee?" "I thought you'd never ask." Inside, she said, as she was tugging her boots off, "To be honest, I never been that big of a sci-fi fan, but I have read Warrior for the Working Day and enjoyed it." She bent down and folded up the wet hems of her pants, then leaned against the back of the living room sofa to massage her toes through the thick wool of her socks. I watched the muscles work in her lower calves. I guessed she was less than 30, perhaps by several years. She looked around the room. "Coffee or hot chocolate?" I asked. Well, whatever you're having. I made hot chocolate and we sat at the kitchen counter talking nuts and bolts, the car that would pick me up, the length of the interview and the questions to be asked, the modest honorarium they would pay, and the huge likely impact of the program on my sales. At this last thought, we shared a smile, then a silence that stretched out 10 or 15 seconds as she looked around again. "Can I tell you something?" she asked, then continued immediately. "I don't want you to think I'm one of those kooks that can read auras and foretell the future, but I do get vibes from this place, you know."
"Oh, vibes?"
She shrugged. "Yeah, nothing profound, just a sense. If you don't mind my saying so, this is a happy house. A lot of good things happened here."
"Oh, must be good feng shui," I said. "Faded bloodstains on the hardwood floors, heavy footsteps in the dark corridors," I thought. "Even the most cosmic scales eventually have to balance."
Jennifer reached across the table and patted the back of my hand. Her fingertips were dry and smooth, and they lingered an extra moment before sliding away.
"Well, if anything, I would say the feng shui sucks," she said. "But you've done a lot of good work here. That must be it."
We talked our way to a conclusion, and I stood by as she climbed back into her boots, coat, and scarf. We shook hands, and I watched her descend the 3 steps to my front walk. I had just closed the door when I heard her cry out. She had slipped on the walk and the top of the second small stairway that led down to the sidewalk. Her left leg was knee-deep in the untouched snow between the steps and the short hedge. She had rocked back and forth, rising from the flagstone, then sinking back down, slapping the stone and moaning, "Oh, dag, now, oh, darn it!" I crouched over her, reached down into the snow, and tried to free her leg, but my first touch made her cry out.
"Can you move at all?"
I said. She winced, took a breath, and nodded. Then together and slowly we slipped her leg free of the snow, and taking her arm across my shoulders, I helped her to her feet. She touched her left foot to the stone gingerly and grimaced.
"Good job, Jen," she muttered.
"We need to get that boot off quickly," I said. "I'll help you inside." 5 minutes later, she was on the sofa leaning back as I completely unlaced one boot and began to work her foot out of it as gently as I could. I could hear her gasp when the boot came free, and I tossed it aside, slipped my fingers into her sock, and slid it down and off the foot. Her ankle was already swollen.
"Keep it still," I said, and she replied, "Yeah, good advice."
I returned with a bundle of ice cubes in a plastic bag.
"I am so sorry," she said. "I've really crash-landed in your life."
I shrugged and settled the ice bag softly against her mottled white skin.
"We need to get you to the ER. Have this x-rayed."
"Oh, you're a knight. Do you know that? A true knight."
"Well," I replied,
"you'll want to reconsider what you said about my feng shui." We recorded the interview the following week with Jen, mobile again but clearly hobbled, lurching around the TV studio on her crutches, fetching things for me as though I were the invalid and she the sound one. I tried to dissuade her. "No, please, I have enough water. Yes, the chair is comfortable." Her painted toes stuck out of the cast. She settled herself in the control room during the interview and met me in the green room afterward. We agreed perfunctorily that the program had gone well. "But I wish we'd gotten more into the subject of pseudonyms," Jen said.
"Well, I wouldn't have much to say about that."
She raised an eyebrow and gave me a small smile that seemed thoroughly rehearsed and yet utterly charming.
"So Magnus Lupo is your real name? The Great Wolf?"
"Why not? It's a perfectly good name."
"Well, for a roller coaster, if your parents actually christened you Great Wolf, that's child abuse. You could have had them prosecuted."
"Or perhaps just gotten tough," I replied.
Look, it's easy to find out who uses what pseudonym. There are websites, search engines. Why don't you just look it up? Oh, I did. All of your pen names refer to each other. You've put yourself in the center of a maze. And why do you care? What's it to you anyway? Well, I'm curious, she replied, holding a water bottle to her lips but not drinking. And stubborn, I've always been fascinated by pen names, especially people who put both their real names and pseudonyms on their books. Joe Schmo writing as Jack Schmuck. It's like they want to hide, but they also want credit. They want everyone to know how clever they are, how one name isn't enough to cover all their output. Maybe their publisher doesn't want to saturate the market, I suggested. Or maybe the author likes to take different styles out for a spin from time to time. Jen leaned forward and stretched out a scratch between her toes where they emerged from the cast. No, I don't buy it, she said. Suppose I could write really fabulously like, I don't know, Melanie Knight. Why would I ever want to dumb down my style to publish under other names? Ever meet Melanie Knight? I said. No. You? I thought I detected a smirk. Then she said, I'd just like to know how many of you there are. Schmuck, you know, is the German word for jewelry, I replied. It's not as derogatory as it sounds. Jen let out a little snort. See, you're so clever. I rest my case. I took my parka from the hook and stepped toward the door. Jen pulled herself awkwardly upright, slipping her crutches under her arms. No, no, don't get up, I said, once it was too late. I'll walk you out, Jen said. I can't just sit here. We progressed slowly down the long corridor to the lobby. Would it really make you happy, I asked, to prove that Magnus Lupo is a pen name? Would you win some prize, finish your doctoral thesis or something? She paused and let her full weight sink onto her crutches. Let's forget the whole thing, she said, looking down at the floor. It seems like fun at first, but kind of like solving a mystery, but I didn't want you to get all huffy and offended. Oh, I'm not. No, really? You're entitled to your secrets. We all are. And what secrets are you keeping? The other day, when you drove through the blizzard, you didn't go to all that elaborate trouble just to flirt with a guy 20 years older than you. Why would I have planned to flirt with you? She said, keeping her eyes from meeting mine. I had never seen so much as a jacket photo of you. One thing about pen names, they never put your photo on the book jacket. Maybe I just don't want to be mobbed everywhere I go by adoring young women. Sure, make a joke, she said. Then in a whisper, pretend you don't want to sleep with me. What gave me away? Nothing, but 7 out of every 10 guys I meet want to take me to bed, and the other 3 are gay, so I figured. Self-esteem is a wonderful thing, I said, and zipped my parka. She hobbled after me to the door and called out, oh, sorry, oh no, don't be. You've been a perfect gentleman, and I've been awful, she said. I don't mean to be. Will I see you again? Well, I can't imagine where or when. In the street, pedestrians were pressed into narrow lanes where the snow had been cleared, and I had to step into the slush several times to yield to others with more urgent business. Meandering and silent, the great wolf took his secrets to the train station. The real estate agent who sold me the house told me its awful story by way of upselling me. The first of my movies had just come out and was doing well. The book had been reissued and was back on the bestseller list, and the agent figured I could afford something much grander. So she led me on a tour of the house because I insisted, talking it down all the while. There were much better views available, even in our non-scenic town. The basement was tiny and cramped. None of the previous owners had made any significant improvements. Finally, as we stood in the kitchen, she did her level best to convince me the house was unlucky if not haunted. All of this was imparted in the spirit of full disclosure, as though she were telling me about termites or a cracked chimney. I was also reassured by the property's ownership history. The original owner, wanted for murder, had dropped from the face of the earth, and inevitably, with the taxes delinquent and the lawn overgrown, the house had been sold for a trivial amount. A dozen other owners followed, none staying more than a year or two. I like that. I like the sense of layers and layers, like living behind a moat, a drawbridge, and a barbed wire fence. 2 weeks later, an extraordinarily long email turned up in my inbox, and it took me a minute or two to realize the message had actually been addressed to Melanie Knight through a Contact the Author email link at our publisher. The email was from Jennifer, of course, and I could hardly reply to it without admitting my secret identities. I wondered if Superman or Batman had similar challenges. Maintaining my cover had never been a problem before. In fact, most readers willingly accepted the good-natured subterfuge of a pseudonym. But not Jennifer. It did not take much reading for me to realize she had me. I had to admit, it was quite a piece of work. Jennifer had started with the apparent coincidence that variants of the same Shakespearean phrase had appeared in the author bios of Jason Lupo and Knight books several years apart. Each bio described the author as fascinated by the lunatic, the lover, and the poet, who, the bard tells us in A Midsummer Night's Dreams, are of imagination all compact. I took a moment to curse lazy publishing house copywriters who had never a notion that anyone would read books by three such different authors, or that they would do more than skim the jacket copy. Jennifer proceeded to identify and dismantle 24 different cases in which similar or even identical language, character traits, or plot events turned up in widely separated novels by all three authors. In no time, I was cursing myself for laziness and marveling at how careless I'd been. I called her on the phone. "So, which is the real me?" I said. "Darned if I know, except I hope I can rule out Melanie. If you started out life as a Melanie, that would be a secret. And you don't believe I'm Magnus Lupo either?" "Well, that leaves Eric Chasen," she said, "which happens to be the name your house is titled in, so I'll go with that. I'll tell you something, though."
"Oh, what?"
"I've never read a syllable of Eric Chasen. Take me out to dinner and tell me all about him." "You young folks today, you don't waste any time," I said. But I did take her out, to an Italian place I'd been meaning to try. After that, we had another glass of wine in front of the fire in my living room, listening to the spring wind rustle the leaves. Then, slowly up the stairs to the master bedroom. "I'm going to need a name to call you," she whispered at the bedroom door.
"Eric'll do," I said, "until I start to howl."
The next morning, as Jen slept in, fetching disarray amid the jumble of bedclothes, I took a half-hour walk, feeling just fine. It had been quite a few years since anyone had shared my bed, yet I had no anxieties last night, and no regrets this morning. Everything, I thought, had gone pretty well. When I returned to the bedroom, Jen, wearing one of my flannel shirts that rose up to reveal her lovely backside, was crouched alongside the bed, running her fingers over the faded red-brown stain that branched toward the corner. "What are you doing?" I said, suddenly having to work hard to breathe. She looked at me over her shoulder and smiled. "If you watched any of those cable home improvement shows, you'd know how to get rid of rust stains like this," she said.
"Yeah, I think the previous owners must have tried."
She stood and crossed the room to me, the shirt front hanging open. I put my arms around her waist. Houses have scars just like people, she said. You could probably write a book.
Maybe by Eric Chason, whom you said you've never read?
I'm looking forward to discovering him, a little at a time.
About a month after the slaughter of my mom and sisters, two state police detectives called on my Aunt Margaret and spent nearly an hour with her in the kitchen. I did not hear them identify themselves, but knew who they were and why they were there. I crouched next to the big armchair in her shabby old parlor and strained to listen. Only once were voices raised when my aunt asked the detectives if they cared to search the house. Evidently, they did not. Afterward, Aunt Margaret caught me by surprise trying to slip away from the parlor.
"They've given up looking," she said. "They didn't think the boy can tell them anything useful anyway. Probably he was frightened out of his wits."
She sat silently a long time, perhaps waiting for me to say something, but I hardly ever spoke in those early days.
"They did say they hoped wherever young Paul was, he had people around him who cared for him."
I nodded quietly, and Aunt Margaret briefly rested a hand on my shoulder before leaving the room. I was 20 when Dad returned for the first time. I was at the university, crossing from my dorm to the library to work on a new short story that I hoped to publish in the campus magazine. The story was my first foray into time travel fiction, my first visit into the territory Magnus Lupo would someday call his own. It posed a twist on the usual change-the-past premise. Instead of finding that any edit of the past, however minor, had pervasive rippling effects throughout the ensuing years, my hero found he could go back in time and change one thing. And this change would have only a single, severely limited chain of direct consequences, leaving the rest of the universe to hum along unaffected. If it were that easy, he comes to ask, who wouldn't want to go back? Who wouldn't want another chance at that dropped pass in the fourth quarter? Another opportunity to kiss the girl instead of chickening out? Another chance to stay in the house instead of abandoning your mother and sisters? And to face the rampaging drunk with the big knife. Because there he was, on the sidewalk in front of me, older, yes, cleanly dressed, looking perhaps a little nervous. "Hello, Paul," he said. I stared at him silently for several seconds until he took a step toward me and I stepped reflexively back. "Whoever you're looking for, it isn't me," I said finally. "My name is Eric." He told me his theory about why he hadn't pursued me into the night. He knew I loved him too much to hurt him, he said. And he knew I would understand that he couldn't favor me as he had the others because, through no fault of mine, he never had loved me as much as he did the girls. Then he slipped two folded $100 bills into my palm and closed my hand briefly in his own and walked off without another word. I continued to the library to work on my story, which today is the earliest surviving work of the sci-fi cult author Magnus Lupo. We met on two more occasions, separated by 5 years. He actually came to the house once, having learned somehow that I had bought it. "You could have just inherited it," he said, "if you'd been willing to own up to who you really were, though God knows how you'd handle the taxes." That time he needed money, and I gave him some. We crossed paths one final time, and he never surfaced again, though I always expected the police would find his body, which I must admit was clumsily hidden. Magnus Lupo's heroes usually discovered that it takes no more effort to change the future than to change the past, and that these changes, deliberate and optimistic instead of rueful, actually do have pervasive effects on a wide circle of people. As the hero of Warrior for the Working Day says in that book's last paragraph, "The past may have made you who you are, but you make who you will be."
so I bought the house, kept scrubbing the floors, and created three faces to show the world: my moat, drawbridge, and barbed wire fence. I lived behind those ramparts until I met a woman who convinced me I had been chastened enough, that the wolf was an endangered species, and that a genuine knight was something worth being. In the end, I have learned there are secrets that don't matter, and secrets everyone already knows, and there are other secrets, ones that do matter, and that nobody knows, and among those secrets are some that the great wolf will take to his grave. Alrighty then, I've switched over to a different issue of the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, a story by John M. Floyd. It's called The Deacon's Game. I was dreaming of my favorite fishing hole when my phone rang. I tossed the just-caught catfish back into the water, rolled on my back, and fumbled for the cell phone on my bedside table. The screen said, Sheriff Ed Lewis. Ronnie, you up? I lay there for several seconds trying to figure out who I was and where I was. Just down the road, a neighbor's rooster crowed. I decided I wasn't on the pond bank after all. What is it, Sheriff? Jerry Deacon, he said. He paused to let this sink in, then added, "You escaped last night. I couldn't get your mother on the phone." I was fully awake now and staring wide-eyed at the ceiling. I'll go tell her. Thanks. I disconnected, heard something move in the dark on the far side of the room, and froze. We'll go together, a voice said. The first time I ever heard that voice, 17 years ago, the words he said to me then were exactly the same. I was 10 years old, and Mom and I lived in a little house near the edge of town on Hope Road. Our street was too short to have more than one sign, and some mischievous soul with a black marker had added a word to make it No Hope Road. Mom once said the altered sign wasn't pretty, but it was appropriate. The day I met Jerry Deacon, Mom had sent me to fetch a loaf of bread from a little grocery store on the corner. I actually enjoyed errands like that, and mowing the yard and raking leaves and such to help out. She worked 6 days a week as a hairstylist in our tiny third bedroom, her beauty parlor, she called it, and had done that ever since Clarence Taylor, my deadbeat father, took off 4 years earlier. Not what you'd call high-end income, but we thank God there were plenty of loyal older ladies around who liked Mom's friendly attitude and her friendly rates. Depressing street sign or not, ours was a simple but happy life. Anyhow, I was on my way to the store for her that summer day when I noticed three older boys, the Dankworth twins and an overweight kid named Bernard something, hanging around the bus stop on this side of the store and eyeing me as I stopped in my tracks. The Dankworths had already beat me up once this month when they cornered me outside the post office, and they must have enjoyed it because they seemed eager to do it again. While I stood there trying to figure out my next move, a tall, handsome man in a t-shirt and faded jeans leaning against an old Chevy across the street caught my eye. He must have also caught the connection between the still blue bruises on my face and the trio of lurking boys, because he came over and said to me, "We'll go together." Without another word, we headed side by side down the walk past the bus stop. I went into the store, and he waited for me outside, and when I came out and made a beeline for home, he stayed behind to have a word with my three would-be tormentors. Only later did I learn that he told them to leave me alone from now on, and if they didn't, he'd kill them and happily stuff their bodies in the dumpsters behind the store. I also learned for myself much later that he'd help me not because of kindness, but because he knew I'd tell my mom what he'd done, and Marilyn Taylor was probably the best-looking divorcee in the county. And sure enough, when I saw my rescuer walking down the street the following week and Mom was sitting with me on the porch, taking a break, I called to him and introduced them. 3 months later, my mother and Jerry Allen Deacon were married. If you're thinking this new father of mine provided some stability and improvement to our little family, you're mistaken. Consistently unemployed, he provided trouble, and that was all for both me and Mom. Fortunately, I already had a father figure in the form of an old widower named Ennis Bonetti, who lived 4 houses down from ours. He was a retired school teacher and devotee of games and puzzles, and despite my pitiful academic record, he had long ago taught me the game of chess, mainly because he needed a willing opponent. In teaching me, he determined that I didn't have a thinking problem. I had a planning problem. I couldn't seem to see past the next couple of moves, and for that reason, I would never be a great player, but I had an uncanny knack for avoiding traps and making brilliant, unexpected moves and changing direction on the spot. What would that gain me in this game of life? Well, probably nothing, he said. Only time will tell. But I can tell you this. In spite of my scholarly shortcomings, I spent many wonderful hours with him over that old chessboard on his front porch. Meanwhile, back at the real home, conditions steadily worsened. My stepfather took to referring to himself as the deacon for some reason, though it sure didn't have any kind of church connection, and began spending more and more time away from home, mostly drinking and gambling, it turned out. Neither Mom nor I minded. She kept most of what the money that she earned hidden, and when he was away, that meant he couldn't vent his temper on her, and sometimes on me. I gradually began doing anything I could, short of inciting a beating, to antagonize him. I guess it was the only way I knew to strike back. Sometimes, though, my needling went right over his head. Once, during supper, my mother asked me what I was reading lately. I still didn't make good grades, but I read at a level beyond my years, and since Jerry was sitting there, I said, "James Fenimore Cooper, the last of them old deacons." I got a sharp warning look from Mom, but nothing but a blank stare from her husband. "Stupid title," he said, before continuing to shovel mashed potatoes into his mouth. As it turned out, after a year of his and my mother's miserable marriage, Jerry Deacon did something truly unforgivable. He robbed our local savings and loan, and in the process shot and killed a teller. Stunned, Mom fled with me to Ennis Bonetti's house and turned Deacon in to the police. His last words before they locked him away for life, words shouted across the courtroom to my mother, were that he would eventually get out and get even. 16 years later, he made good on the first half of that threat, as I learned via the call from Sheriff Eddie Lewis the morning after the escape, and when, a moment later, I heard Jerry's voice and saw his face there in the dark corner of my bedroom, I knew he had also come to get even. "Think your mom'll be glad to see the deacon?" Jerry asked. I could see his eyes in the rearview mirror, glittering eyes that seemed to have a hardened imprison. Beside him, in the front passenger seat, was a pudgy man with a crew cut and a tattooed neck and a twisted grin. A cellmate? An ally from outside? No way to knowing. He had turned and was looking at me also, and pointing an automatic at me that they'd probably stolen while fleeing the prison. "This is Bull Willis," Jerry said to me. "Say hi to my stepson, Bull, or former stepson, I guess, since I'm divorced now." Bull's grin twisted even more. He reminded me of the kid who used to run around with the Dankworth twins. Jerry and Bull had thrown me into the back seat of an old purple wide-bodied Ford, the only purple car I think I'd ever seen, without bothering to tie my hands, not that it mattered, with the gun aimed at me. And we were currently headed south toward Mom's workplace. She now had a separate little beauty salon located halfway between our old place, where she still lived, and the little house I'd moved into a couple of years ago. Jerry apparently knew all this. He'd sure known where to find me. He probably also knew Mom always arrived at work half an hour before her first customer. What he didn't know was that on Mondays, my mother didn't open until 9, an hour later than usual. My bedside clock had said 7:20 when they dragged me from my room, and the drive would take 15 minutes, so their plans were about to go awry. Could I use that? I didn't see how. I could hear old Mr. Bonetti's voice now. "You can't seem to plan ahead, Ronnie." "Bull, this boy's dumb as a post. Always has been. Almost flunked out of school. Sure as heck didn't go to college, and now he's working at a filling station." Bull, whose college experience were probably limited as well, just grinned wider, which was all the more scary. "Guess you won't be showing up for work today, Ronnie boy," Jerry added. "Somebody else'll have to pump gas and fix flats tomorrow and from now on." Both of them thought that that was hilarious. I was barely listening. Moments earlier, I noticed a pair of sparkly pink-framed sunglasses lying on the wide flap top of the dashboard in front of Jerry, clear proof to me that they'd stolen this car from somebody during the night. I hoped they hadn't killed the woman driving it, but there was no telling what these two were capable of. As I was thinking this, Jerry made a sharp left-hand turn into the glare of the rising sun, making the glasses slide across the dashboard shelf all the way to the right. I dimly remembered a lecture in inertia or centrifugal force in science class, and come to rest right in front of his passenger. "Hand me them sunglasses, Bull." The big man handed them over, and Jerry put them on, not seeming to mind how stupid they looked on him. "You know what, kid," Jerry continued, "I ain't decided whether to shoot your mama quick or let her watch me shoot you first. I'll ask her preference. Either way, my first shot always goes to the stomach so they can suffer a while, then one to the head just to make sure." I could feel the sweat inside my shirt, my churning in my gut. I knew I couldn't just sit there. I had to do something, but what? Maybe when we stopped, which we did, within minutes. Jerry spat a curse when he saw no car in front of Mom's salon, but got out anyway to check. Bull stayed put in the front seat, keeping both the gun and his eyes on me in the back. Fuming, he stomped back to the car and motioned both of us out onto the driveway with him. To Bull, he said, "You go round back and break in and stay there till she gets here. If she does, show her your gun and wait for me, right?" Then he turned to me. "Get in, kid, you're driving." "Where?" "Your mama's house. I might not know everything about her work hours, but I know where she lives now. We'll give her a wake-up surprise like the one I gave you." I stood there trembling in the early morning sun, wondering whether to fight or run. But they were armed and I wasn't. Jerry's gun, a big revolver, was out and aimed now. "I told you to get in," he said. I did, and realized too late I probably should have tried to drive off and leave them right there. In any case, the moment passed. Deegan climbed into the passenger seat, still wearing the ridiculous sunglasses. He turned and leveled his revolver at me. "Let's go meet sweet Marilyn." Reality had finally set in for me, and I was terrified. The dashboard clock said 7:52. I'd known Mom would not be at the salon yet, but I also knew she would be at home, probably halfway through her breakfast by now. I hadn't been surprised when the sheriff had been able to raise her on the phone, her cell phone. She was notorious about letting the battery run down. The phone she relied on was the landline. I was delivering a murderer to my mother so he could kill us both, and I had no way to stop it. Unless... There's always a move, Mr. Bonetti had said, if you think and look long enough. From the corner of my eye, I checked out my passenger seatbelt. It was unbuckled. Just ahead, there was, I knew, a T-intersection at the bottom of the hill where the road we were on butted into the long north-south street. I would need to take a left there, onto the cross street, but I also remembered a giant oak beside the road at the very top of the T. What if I accelerated down that hill and instead of turning left, kept going straight, blasting right into that tree? We'd both probably be killed, but I, with the seatbelt buckled, would at least stand a chance. Jerry Deacon would keep going, no airbags in this old car, head first through the windshield and into a 4-foot-thick tree trunk, and Mom would be saved. We started down the hill now, and I sped up a little, but Jerry figured it out. Moving fast, he laid the revolver on top of the dashboard in front of him, well out of my reach, and with both hands drew the end of the seatbelt together. My heart sank. I no longer had the advantage. I slowed down a bit, but we were still flying down the hill toward the top of the T. I heard the snap as he buckled his belt. "Just so you won't try nothing," he said. "Turn left at the bottom of the hill." But I didn't turn left. I had a new plan, one that had just popped into my head. I turned right, a hard and unexpected right, at high speed, and both of us were thrown to the left. I watched Jerry Deacon's revolver slide toward me across the top of the dash. Frantically, he reached for it, but he was off balance from the force of the turn, and I reached too, as planned, and the heavy gun slid straight into my open right palm. Fighting the wheel with my left hand, tires screaming, I straightened the car, which threw Jerry back toward the door. Then I saw him swivel again toward me, a knife raised high, now in his right fist. I turned to him, too, and shot him twice in the stomach. The noise in the enclosed space was deafening. The knife fell to the floorboards. I watched his mouth go wide and his eyes bug almost from their sockets. But I wasn't quite finished. Remembering all the beatings he'd given Mom, I shot him 3 more times, and when finally I braked to a stop, I raised the gun higher and shot him once in the head just to be sure. I sat there for a long moment, breathing hard. The car skewed across ways in the road. Other vehicles were stopping, doors were opening, people gawking. I paid them no attention. I took out my cell phone, called Sheriff Lewis, told him what had happened, and also told him to first go quick to my mom's beauty salon, where an armed man named Bull Wills was inside and waiting. "Watch the back," I said. "That's where he got in." Lewis wasted no time with questions. Seconds later, he and a deputy were en route in a cruiser, and he kept me on the line. "Ronnie," he said, "do not go to your mother's beauty parlor, understand?" "Oh, I won't," I said. "I was going to her house. Besides, I'm out of bullets." When I told Mom about all this, she, understandably, I suppose, almost passed out. It didn't help that I had driven up in a car with blood-spattered window and her ex-husband's body inside. The good thing was Sheriff Lewis and his deputy found Bull, real name Broderick Willis, asleep in one of Mom's salon chairs, and he was taken into custody without injury to himself or the arresting officers. I wouldn't have minded if they'd kicked him in the crotch a time or two as they took him away, but I didn't mention that to the sheriff when he reported all this to Mom and me at her house. He had enough on his mind after seeing the result of my front seat shootout. When he asked me how I managed to do that, I just said, "Inertia." He probably figured I'd gone the rest of the way crazy. As it turned out, the vintage Ford in which Jerry Deacon met his sad but well-deserved end had indeed been stolen from a red-headed woman named Estelle Luckenbill, who, when I saw her later on the news, looked exactly like someone who would own a purple car and a pair of sparkly pink sunglasses. Estelle, too, was unharmed since the theft took place in the middle of the night in the middle of her driveway while she was asleep. But after a few choice words about the thieves and their ancestry, she swore to the viewing audience that she would never leave her keys in the parked car after dark again. The only casualty of all this, besides Jerry, was the prison guard he and Bull had killed while escaping and whose guns they'd stolen, one from his holster and another from his desk. When Mom had calmed down, that took a while, she said a prayer for the guard, and so did I. The strangest thing to come of all of this was that I was contacted by phone that night after the 6 o'clock news by Jack and James Dankworth, who no longer lived here. They were now employed by a sleazy ambulance-chasing law firm in Memphis. But they wanted to thank me for finally freeing them from what they perceived to be an ongoing threat to their lives by that psycho Jerry Deacon all those years ago at the bus stop beside the grocery store on Hope Road. They said they hadn't had a worry-free night's sleep since then. When I asked what had become of thug number 3 in their group, they said Bernard Huff was now a full-time telemarketer, which means all 3 of them wound up selling their souls to the devil. I wish Jerry Deacon had stuffed them into the dumpster. As for old Mr. Benetti, he seemed honestly pleased that he had not lost his only chess partner and was also happy to hear that some of his long-ago advice had helped me out in my hour of need. I told him I now agreed that in almost any game you find a good move if you study the board long enough, or maybe, I thought, if you need one bad enough. That night, when all was said and done, and the media scavengers had gnawed the bones and slunk away in search of their next story, I hugged my mother and assured her I truly was all right. I almost couldn't believe myself how little I regretted blowing Jerry Deacon's brains out and most of his innards. But I also told her that history had been made today. Bing Lassiter, owner of the Exxon station where I worked, had, for the first time ever, given me the day off. Aside from that, nothing much had changed. Unlike Jerry's prediction this morning, I would still be around, after all, to pump gas and change oil and fix flats, tomorrow and from now on. Around midnight, I switched off the lights, locked my doors, climbed into bed, and dreamed of my favorite fishing hole. This time, no one and no phone calls woke me up, and I managed to hook a dozen catfish and threw none of them back. Let's hear it for the simple life. Well, wonderful people, that's the end of this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler here saying thank you so much for joining me, and tune in again next time, if you would, please. Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.